We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour, we'll be talking about women's health, something that we do every other month on a Monday. And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Trupin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has her own practice here in our area, women's health practice. She's also clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the U of I in the med school. And she is here on a regular basis to answer questions. She usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new, and we can do that, but also we are here to answer questions. And so if there's something specific that you'd like to talk about that falls into her area of practice, I know that she will do her best to help you out and maybe add a little bit to your health knowledge. We cannot diagnose over the phone. I try always to say that when we have physicians here. If you have a problem, you really need to discuss with someone, you have to make an appointment to get them to see you. But here on the program, well, it's a place to start, and it's a place to ask some basic questions and get some basic answers, and that's what we'll do. Questions are certainly welcome. And here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call, and that is 800-222-9455. We also have email, so you can send along your question that way. You write us at willtalk, that's will-talk, at illinois.edu. At any point here, we'll take questions. Thanks very much for being here once again.
Good morning.
And I know that you come and you grab stuff and you...
I grab things off the internet, see what people are chatting
about. So what are people chatting about these days?
A lot on endometriosis, a lot on contraception, quite a bit on sterilization, ovarian cancer screening, breast cancer screening, prevention, a lot of questions like that.
Yeah, okay.
Osteoporosis, always a good topic.
Yeah.
Vitamin D levels.
All right. Well, certainly those are things that we've talked about before. If people have questions about that, specific questions, they can give us a call. You want to just pick something to start with?
Absolutely. I thought it was fascinating in a story I saw on endometriosis that I've always talked about how the average delay in diagnosis is somewhere between 6 and 9 years. But this particular story talked about how many different physicians patients see in the process of getting their diagnosis of endometriosis, which, you know, the lining of the uterus is called the endometrium, or those who know about this disease. And when that tissue gets implanted inside a woman's abdomen, in other words, ectopic lining tissue, it becomes a painful condition that can also lead to infertility, and it's known as endometriosis. And because it's internal, it is more difficult to diagnose. And some of the implants are literally something that is the size and dimension of the head of a pin and can't really be picked up by an ultrasound or a pelvic exam or an MRI or some sophisticated examination. And so many women escape detection, and accurate detection can really only be made by a surgical diagnosis. And many women who carry the diagnosis have only had that diagnosis made what we call presumptively, based on just the set of circumstances surrounding their symptoms. But the average number of doctors that a woman has seen prior to getting that diagnosis is 6.
That must be terribly frustrating for women who know, they feel something's wrong.
Correct.
But they can't get somebody to figure out what.
So it's difficult to diagnose. Uh-huh. There are very few treatments. Mm-hmm. And what's more amazing is there currently is no treatment for what we call recurrent endometriosis. So even when we make that diagnosis, maybe we've treated it either surgically or medically, maybe perhaps this treatment has been successful for a period of time and now the patient's either conceived or been pain-free, but now she has recurrent disease or perhaps refractory disease where the treatment, maybe she's even undergone the best treatment, say the injection Lupron, and now the disease has recurred. There is actually no treatment for recurrent disease out there.
And, you know, this is something we've talked about in the past, that maybe some of the mechanisms here, that is how the uterine tissue, instead of being flushed out the way that it's supposed to, why does it end up getting into the body? Maybe some people think, well, they think they know how that could happen, but there's still some uncertainty really about how it is you explain that.
Well, we think that many years ago, women didn't really have consistent menstrual periods. We were either starving, we didn't get very old, we were pregnant, we were breastfeeding. There were other reasons that we just didn't menstruate very regularly. But modern women ovulate about 400 times and probably have about 400 menstrual periods. And we've discovered that virtually all of them will bleed out their fallopian tubes and into the abdominal cavity, as well as out onto their menstrual pads or tampons or whatever they can see. And therefore, there is tissue being presented to the abdominal cavity. And scientific research shows that genetically, some of this tissue is different and is more likely to implant. And whether that tissue genetically becomes different or was different previously, we don't really understand. But there probably are other factors as well, because we think, again, that probably 100% of women who have menstrual periods will have this tissue present in their abdomen, and somewhere between 5 and 10% of women will have endometriosis.
So it's a common problem, and yet only in a very small number of cases do women actually develop endometriosis.
Right.
And it's because that tissue, it gets into the body and it responds to the natural hormonal patterns just the way the uterine lining does. Basically,
well,
yes?
Yes, it will. And it responds abnormally. And so there may be times when it is responding to low levels of hormones at other times in the menstrual cycle. So it's not just that a woman will have her endometriosis pain when she expects her cycle.
And what are the major symptoms, most common symptoms?
Pelvic pain, pain with menstrual periods, pain with intercourse, and just pain with ovulation, but pain.
And the most common treatments?
Well, most women will start out with a birth control or a progesterone-type treatment. The subcutaneous treatment of Depo-Provera is a therapy. Excuse me, I was in the research study that studied that. The gold standard years ago used to be the medication danazol, but it's a male hormone that has some male hormone side effects. The GnRH injection Lupron, I was actually in the original Lupron study, has been a treatment. And we're now looking at more modern treatments, other kinds of selective progesterone modulators, or perhaps GnRH agonists. Other kinds of treatments are being studied in research protocols, and we're usually having an endometriosis study ongoing at all times and always looking for people to email us and say, hey, do I qualify? It's tough to qualify for an endometriosis study, but we're always anxious to get those emails.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice here in our area. Every other month she's here on the program, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller in line is in Crete on our toll free line here, line 4. Hello.
Hello, doctor.
Yes.
Hello, I'm calling because recently I have been told that I exhibited a symptom which requires a follow-up uterine biopsy. With that in mind, I visited two doctors. Each doctor would do this biopsy in quite a different way, and I have no way of knowing which is the better one, period, or which is the better one for me.
Well, that would be a tough question to answer over the internet here or over the telephone. So basically a uterine biopsy, most people when they're talking about a uterine biopsy are talking about evaluating the lining of the uterus. And the lining of the uterus can be evaluated in a number of ways. The pap smear doesn't typically evaluate the lining of the uterus, although a few cells are shed from the lining and can be picked up on pap smear. The lining of the uterus can be evaluated by ultrasound, and merely the thickness of the lining of the uterus is an indication of normalcy or abnormalcy. And depending on exactly how normal that is, some evaluators are content to stop there. However, if symptoms go on long enough, some physicians feel that you do need to have a more thorough evaluation. Now, if someone has symptoms that are either continuing on or based on the uterine ultrasound, then an actual tissue sample has to be obtained.
Yes, and that's where they differ. I have already had the ultrasound, and I've seen two doctors. One doctor would do a complete DNC and also take a piece out of the cervix and also do an MRI. This seemed to me like an awful lot. This was an older gentleman, and I was thinking maybe this is an old-fashioned way. The other doctor I saw was younger, would just do a siphoning, a sort of suction biopsy with a camera attached. No biopsy to the cervix. And I don't know which one will bring in the greater certainty of cancer, yes or no. I'm looking for, if I go through something like this, I would like to have my result be certain. Yes, it is cancer. No, it isn't cancer. No wondering about it.
Well, the word certainty in medicine is a problematic word. What you want is to know statistics. And again, there is an intermediate step beyond an actual ultrasound, and that would be a saline infusion ultrasound. But the next step usually after the ultrasound, depending on the findings, is usually an office endometrial biopsy. Now, depending on which statistics you follow, that office endometrial biopsy is going to be accurate in the range of 80 to 90%, meaning that it's very accurate, but it can't get all the cases. Now, most physicians do not stop that day in terms of evaluating their patients. So number one, it depends on what the finding is. And number two, it depends on what the patient's symptoms are going forward in time.
That doctor would use a camera too, and I would be out.
Well, again, there are cameras attached to even 3-millimeter scopes. Again, there is some variance. For instance, I have a 3-millimeter hysteroscope that can be done under local when you're awake and watching the television screen.
No, I cannot be awake.
Exactly. Not everybody can. So there are variances. The American College of OBGYN has a website. I think the Society of Gynecologic Oncologists has a website. I believe WebMD has good information. I think the Mayo Clinic website has good information. And I think that if you need further information, that those are good.
I don't know which of these is better, that let the gentleman do the complete D&C with a piece out of the cervix, or let the young lady do this. And I don't think I'll get that from a website.
Well, if you really are struggling with the information that two physicians have given you, you unfortunately may have to go see a third physician. Because without seeing the ultrasound, without knowing the medical case, and without...
The ultrasound shows a lot of blood thickening in the uterus.
I know
that
that's...
And my pap smear yielded to endometrial cells on the cervix.
Well, endometrial cells don't grow on the cervix, and I'm not trying
to
be glib,
but
that doesn't mean that they're on the cervix. That means that they were in the pap. That means they were shed from the uterine lining in, into the pap.
And found on the pap, yes.
Right. So traditionally, what we have said from the days when we did slide tests is very unusual to find endometrial cells on the pap smear, and therefore we want to rule out an endometrial carcinoma, which you have to do with a tissue sample. And simple biopsies typically will give you that answer.
And I'm going to have to jump in here. I have another caller, and I kind of think we've done about what we can do for the caller. I hope that that's helpful, but I hope people also understand that there are real limitations of what we can do here because we're dealing with people over the phone, and the doctor can't see the patient, and they can't see all the tests that have been done and so forth. So I hope that that is at least partially helpful. Other questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have another caller here, and they are in Champaign, and that's line number one. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Troopin.
Hello.
I delivered my baby with you in December, and I actually lost all the weight that I had gained and everything, but I had some really big marks just on the right side of my tummy area, and I really thought that they would shrink down and go away, you know, after I lost the weight with the sit-ups and everything. But unfortunately, I still got some marks that are different colors. Is there
so they're red? Are they red? Like they look like stretch marks, but they're red.
I've got a couple that are red and one that's white. They're different colors.
Okay. So typically with rapid weight gain and then loss, which pregnancy is actually rapid, many women, depending on their genetic makeup, will develop stretch marks. And we think that there are many factors, and hormones play a big part. Actually, weightlifters, men who have done weightlifting and use some hormones actually have a problem with this. Certain individuals who have, say, steroid hormone abnormalities, individuals with polycystic ovarian condition, individuals with Cushing's disease will develop certain kinds of one of the medical terms is stria. And sometimes they can be very large. Sometimes they can be smaller. Sometimes they can be very bright red. And as they get older, they tend to be white. So whatever you're seeing that is white might have been something older that you perhaps did not notice. And then there tends to be some laxity of the skin around it. And in youth, there tends to be some tightening of that. It's usually a laxity physically of the skin. It has nothing to do with your underlying muscles, although in pregnancy, as we grow, there's a large muscle that runs down our abdomen that can separate, and that will tighten up. And with abdominal work, that muscle will get back in shape, and that will make your abdomen, of course, look a lot better. But physical skin tightening, good nutrition, minimizing the amount of weight that you actually gained and lost in pregnancy, it does help. But now there has actually been an FDA-approved laser treatment. It is considered cosmetic, so it's FDA-approved, but your insurance company won't consider it medical. And it will both decrease the appearance of stretch marks and tighten the skin. And in the clinical trials with this laser, which is a Palomar medical laser, it's a 1540 wavelength laser, in their trials, virtually 100% of people had some improvement, up to about 50% improvement, and about 30 to 50% got virtually 100% cure of their stretch marks. And so when you treat stretch marks like that, you treat once a month over three treatments, and then you watch over time, and even up to 1 year later, you get additional skin tightening and improvement, but usually those first three treatments are successful within 3 to 5 months. You won't see the color. And it's very interesting how it can remove both red and white, in that it's actually recruiting the normal melanocytes, the cells that color our skin, from around the area. So the normal melanocytes move into that area and normalize the color. So red leaves and white gets colorized in. And to some extent, the red color is neutralized by the wavelength of the light, too. So it's a little bit more complex. But it has to do with the physiology of the skin that it's targeting. It's very effective. People like to do it. And it's not horribly expensive, but it is considered cosmetic.
So this is for stretch marks, but I can get this anywhere.
No, probably not. It's really specific for this particular type of laser. It's a fractional laser. It's a Palomar laser. And I do have one of those machines. There may be others available, but around the state. But it's with the fractional laser. It's a new technology.
Does it hurt?
It appears like a sunburn after you've had it done. So the skin will feel warm. Like if you've been out in the sun too much, you can feel a little bit discomfort. And while you're having the treatment done, it can feel like maybe a rubber band stinging your skin, something like that. But not extremely painful, no.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for your help.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We're midway through this part of Focus. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, has a practice in our area, and she's also a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. Every other month, she's here on the program to talk about women's health, and we'll do her best to answer questions if you want to give us a call. Well, we talked a little bit about endometriosis. Are there some other things that you'd like to mention that are
Well, we were
new?
Just talking about the hysteroscopic kind of procedure. The other caller mentioned looking physically inside the uterus. And there are two forms of hysteroscopic sterilization that are FDA approved. I think we talked about the Escher type of sterilization where coils are put inside the fallopian tubes at the junction where the fallopian tubes meet the uterine cavity. And now there is a procedure, Adiana, and it is very different than the Escher. Also, it's done through the cervix. It's also done under either local anesthesia or a little bit of sedative. So very minimal anesthesia is required. It's very quick. It's an 11-12 minute procedure, and once the little inserts are placed, they look like a little piece of rice. They're a sort of a silicone base, so no metal. They are placed with a technology that allows the placement to be checked, and they are then essentially sort of buzzed into place with a little radio frequency, and then they do have to scar in place over the next 3 months. So you're not sterile the moment that you get the operation, and their placement does have to be checked over after 3 months' time with a what we call a hysterosalpingogram, that X-ray study to determine that the fallopian tubes are in fact blocked. But it's very non-invasive. And I really feel that these methods of transcervical sterilization are going to become the standard because they are so safe compared to the traditional laparoscopic tubal ligations, which are very safe, but these have even a greater measure of safety. And once the placement of these inserts are checked, failure is extremely remote. So they are gaining popularity rapidly.
But still, now at the moment, is it though it's still more common that the tubes are actually cut?
Yes. Again, training, equipment costs, and availability. So I believed that I was the first that started the Adyana procedure, and there are several physicians in our community that do Esher procedures, but I'm still not sure exactly how available it is.
Yeah, so the newer procedures, they're less invasive. How's the cost compare?
Well, it should theoretically be a similar cost, but the inserts themselves cost something. Mm-hmm. So probably just a little bit more expensive overall than sterilization. But insurance company-wise, it shouldn't be very different.
And is it still the case that actually now sterilization is the most popular form of contraception?
Well, if you look at the group age 35 and over, probably sterilization is the most popular, but they look at couples and capture vasectomies and infertility as well in that whole group. So the numbers are a little odd.
Okay. We have another caller here, somebody else calling from the community of Crete. So we'll go there to our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, my wife left a couple of questions for you. She's selling homes, hopefully. The first one involves something she said is TrueTest, or the towel brush by Gynecor, that supposedly is a new method of detecting cancer. That's the first question. Do you know anything about this new revelation? The second one is, if she goes in to have a checkup, they want to do a check for cancer or something, can she go in and have a biopsy and say, hey, they'll take the specimen out of the room, check it out, and say, don't move her, we'll have a hysterectomy because she has cancer? In other words, a whole procedure at one time rather than twice going in. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I think so. Well, typically hysterectomies are not typically performed that way, but everybody has to work with their own gynecologist to figure out if that is going to be a good solution for them or not. When we perform a hysterectomy for a gynecologic indication, usually it's based on a final diagnosis. And a final diagnosis is usually based on a thorough pathologic examination, which may or may not be possible to do on what's called a frozen section. And typically, gynecologic first step evaluation procedures are relatively quick. They're in the range of a few minutes, and even a rapid frozen section, that diagnosis is now going to stretch out anesthesia for somewhere half an hour, something like that. So actually, it would probably add morbidity. Also, in terms of scheduling the prep that would have to be done, the consultation that would have to be done, the preoperative workup. If somebody had cancer, they would typically have a different preoperative workup than just a biopsy that probably wouldn't have been done just prior to that biopsy. So it probably wouldn't add anything to the safety of the operation. It probably, in fact, would compromise the safety of most operations and would probably compromise the planning of the appropriate treatment. So in most cases, it's not done as a one-step procedure. In terms of the Gynecor TrueTest, I'm not sure if I'm getting the right product name. But there is a new test that has just come onto the market that is going to test it's going to be an adjunct to an actual pap smear. And it is going to, so pap smears look at an actual cytologic change of the cells of the cervix. And then the next step is an FDA-approved use of women over the age of 30 of using the HPV test to predict the abnormality of the accuracy of that cytological change if high-risk HPV exists. And there are several of these tests. There's the Qiagen test, and There's now a Hologic test that is a, you can also get a 1618 specific test. So there are a few tests out there, and then there are two or three companies working on newer tests that test for additional HPV types that haven't been on the market before. Then there's a brand new test that is newly approved, available in some labs, but I have not found it so well reimbursed yet by my patients' insurance companies. And it tests for DNA perturbation by the HPV virus. And their theory is that just because the HPV virus is there, if it hasn't altered the DNA yet, that it's a little bit less likely to cause it a change. Now, in the ASCCP, the American Society of Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology guidelines that go incorporate the Bethesda guidelines for reading out cervical pathology, and most organizations go by their general recommendations. They have a fabulous website for pap smear recommendations that I think is understandable by patients and clinicians alike. They incorporate pap smear testing and HPV testing. They have not moved to incorporate this new test of the DNA change. And so it's a little bit problematic to know exactly what to do with that result. And so it's spending a fair amount of money for some patients out of pocket that probably isn't going to actually change their clinical management quite yet.
What's the name of the new test?
I'd have to look it up. It may be this GynaCore-True test that you're talking about. Off the top of my head, I would have to look it up. If you write me an email, I can look it up for you.
And ASCCP stands for American.
It's American. It's ASCCP.org is their website, but it stands for American Society of Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It would be really, I'm sure for everyone, for doctors and patients, it would be really great if we had a whole battery of non-invasive screens and tests that we could do, you know, say like you could just take some blood and look at that and figure out, does somebody have cancer?
Well, we are moving to that. There is so much exciting. Yeah. And of course, it'd be even nicer if we didn't have to take blood, you know, move a probe across you and all kinds of things. For instance, there's a fascinating new test for pregnancy, and it's just come out. It's, I think it's the Sequinom company, and they can look at maternal blood for fetal DNA. And what they can do, for instance, is take maternal blood, look for fetal DNA, and then based on that, they can determine if your pregnancy, if the baby has Rh positive or Rh negative blood. They can determine sex now too, if you want to find out. But medically, this is important because we probably overtreat with Rogam. If you recall, most Rh negative moms actually carry an Rh positive fetus. If they carry an Rh-positive fetus, they might potentially make antibodies to that fetus, thereby either harming that pregnancy, not very likely, or in subsequent pregnancy, those antibodies could potentially cause very serious problems, Rh sensitization. So we've come up with a scheme that if you have bleeding in pregnancy, if you get to 28 weeks, we treat all moms that are Rh-negative, unless we absolutely know that the dad was Rh negative too. But let's just say, for all intents and purposes, across the United States, we treat all moms that are Rh negative with a blood product known as Rogam. Well, if we could, cost is no object and everybody wants to know, then we could test all moms now, brand new test, just released, just approved. We could test all moms now for this fetal DNA, and then we would be withholding this blood product treatment from at least 40% of moms during pregnancy. So I think that's where we're going to move. We're going to move to targeted treatments, because even our pap smears, we basically round all women up and say, okay, women of the United States, here's your plan for pap smear testing. And that's sort of what we do with mammograms, and that's sort of what we do with cholesterol. Well, that's silly. And we know that there are groups of patients that have more risk than other groups. And we are tailoring some tests based on risks or symptoms, but in fact, genetic risk is probably going to be our biggest factor.
So do you, for example, on pap smear, then, does that mean you envision a time when all women will not have them, or it's this that maybe all women will have them at some time, but all women won't have them in the same intervals, or that you're going to tailor what testing you do to the individual person?
It's such a good question. And of course, we need to look ahead, and we need to say, okay, what percent of our population is going to be vaccinated against HPV? What percent of our male population will be vaccinated against HPV? A study was released last year where they looked at, from very young girls up to about age 15, prior to any sexual activity, and, you know, you can think what you want in terms of abuse or whatever, but they did genital cultures and found prior to the onset of sexual activity, a fair percentage of girls do test positive for the HPV virus. And the suggestion is that auto-inoculation, touching, diapering, all kinds of ways to transmit this virus. And that, of course, sexual activity is the biggest factor by far. And yet there are other factors. But as we move forward in time and we get the population vaccinated, no, we're not going to need to do nearly as many PAPs. And we're already experiencing that change in medical practice, so that when I was a teenager, it was recommended that we do our first pap smear at age 16, and now it's recommended that first pap smear be age 21. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge change. Huge.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Suzanne Truppin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign once every other month. She is here, and we talk about women's health. And the idea is that we try to answer questions. All questions cannot be answered, but I know she'll do her best. You want to give us a call, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also send your emails, if you like, to will-talk. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else that you'd like to get into?
Well, I was telling you that my most active post on my regular blog is talking about the Mirena IUD and whether or not it has effects on sex drive. So I thought, I continually get questions on this, so I thought that it would be a good topic to talk about. And as you know, IUD recommendations have changed a lot as well. So we have two IUDs on the market. We have Paragard and we have Mirena. And Paragard is a non-medicated IUD. It essentially is the old copper T type of IUD. It's approved in the United States for 10 years of use. And because of the copper, some women may experience a slightly heavier menstrual period, but it's very safe and very effective and has been approved in a wide range of individuals and has become extremely popular. And then there's the Mirena IUD, and it's shaped a slight bit different. If you glanced at it, it might be look a little more Y-shaped than T-shaped. And in the bar part of the Y, it is a carrier for a little bit of progesterone that is the levonorgestrel type of progesterone. And because it leaks progesterone locally, it provides contraceptive protection, not only being an IUD sitting there, but by forming a progesterone mucus block to the cervix and changing the lining of the uterus so that women won't necessarily have a menstrual period or extremely light menstrual period. And that Mirena IUD leaking a small amount of progesterone does get a very low level of progesterone blood level that one could detect if we hunted for it. Clinically, we don't usually do blood levels of this type, but it is known that the blood level is extremely low. And the Mirena IUD is a five-year IUD in the United States, extremely effective. Women, again, can have this before they have children, although before you have a child, your uterus is, in fact, smaller than if after you have a child. So the expulsion rate for IUD users prior to having children is slightly higher. But they're very, very popular. And I think the Mirena probably is, at least in my practice, a little bit more popular than the Paragard IUD. And there's always been a lot of discussion about whether sex drive improves or decreases or stays the same if you use an IUD, because many users of oral contraception do report a slightly decreased sex drive, because we do know that birth control pills have the potential, not in every case, but they have the potential to slightly decrease testosterone and therefore decrease sex drive due to lower testosterone levels. So some people are switchers from birth control pills to IUDs. And then the question is, okay, if you switched and your sex drive improved, does that mean it improved? Would it have improved had you not been using the birth control pill, just relative to the pill or because of the IUD itself? In others who hadn't been on any steroid contraception and, for instance, used the Mirena IUD with that low level of progesterone, is there perhaps some vaginal dryness or irritation or the spotting that some people get, particularly in the beginning, causing changes in sex drive or arousal? So a lot of discussion in the actual Mirena trials. I think the actual reported rates of sexual dysfunction were low in the 3-5% range, but it does generate a lot of questions on my blog.
Uh-huh. Okay. We have about 5 minutes left here, and I have an email here who I've had for a little bit. I want to make sure that I get in while we have time, from someone who writes and says she doesn't remember if this has ever been covered on the show. She says she's always had inverted nipples. She says she's in her 50s, and she'd like to reverse it. And she says, is it possible? If so, what would the procedure be? And she says it's something that's always bothered her, but that she's been too embarrassed to ask her doctor about it.
Well, they're very normal, and probably physicians never mention anything because it is normal. Many women who have had inverted nipples and choose to breastfeed, when you try to breastfeed and the hormone levels and enough engorgement at that time, sometimes you can get them to physically pop out like that. There are procedures that cosmetic procedures that have been done to get nipples to be more perpetually popped out, that can be done. They aren't always successful, but they usually are. Some people have actually tried fillers, the cosmetic kinds of fillers, like the hyaluronidase fillers, which are perfectly safe, but they metabolize out so rapidly. I mean, might work, but it probably would metabolize out, and they wouldn't last. So probably not necessarily a good solution. Probably would be a little bit of money and wouldn't be necessarily happy in the long run. But because it isn't abnormal, it's just a known variant, anatomic variant. Now, if somebody always had a non-inverted nipple, that suddenly became inverted, we worry about that, meaning that something underlying in the tissue actually caused the nipple to be adherent. And that's a different condition. But something that's longstanding like that is, it's actually just natural variant.
All right. Well, it's something that it escaped my mind before, but when we were talking about HPV and the vaccination for human papillomavirus, that I did want it to get back to, and once it sort of came back to my mind, are we going to get to the point where it will be recommended that boys?
Well, they
get
do.
It, too?
It is approved. It is now approved for
but
boys.
But is that really? Are we really now saying, okay, boys should have it too, or are we not quite at that point?
Well, I think that I guess the question is, who's the we? Sure. I think that it's of known benefit for young men and boys to have the vaccination. Now, for them, the primary benefit is to decrease genital wart disease. And will it decrease HPV transmission to females? Of course it will. It's more difficult to show that in large population studies, but there are actually some large population studies where they've shown that as well. But the individual benefit to them, if they get Gardasil vaccination that covers 6 and 11 as well as 16 and 18 is to prevent genital warts. Penile cancer secondary to HPV 16 and 18 is known, but it's so rare in our country that it would be very difficult to prove that someone was going to be protected against it. And there is a lot of evidence that a majority, literally somewhere between 50 and 75% of oral cancers are secondary to one of the HPV viruses. So we feel that with vaccinations, we will actually see a decrease in oral cancers as well. And cofactors to oral cancers are smoking and tobacco chewing. So definitely for young men, there's protection there as well.
Well, you raise an interesting question. I suppose with girls, the we, yes, who would be the we? Well, I guess that could be the American Academy of Obstetrics and Gynecology. For boys, I don't know, would it be the pediatricians?
Pediatricians, family
practice
and internal medicine. And good question off the top of my head. I'm not sure of their current position on that. It would be good for me to know. I should know. But I don't know their exact positions on that. I'll try to find out for you.
Okay. So it sounds as if, though, that we there I go again. It seems that's the direction we're going. At some
Absolutely.
Point, it should be. We should not be surprised if it's also recommended for boys.
When it comes to sexually transmitted diseases, I think vaccination is absolutely the way to go. We're working on herpes vaccination. It's a trial that I've been involved in, not currently enrolling anyone. We're working on vaccinations against chlamydia. It's also a trial I've been involved in. Of course, screening of asymptomatic carriers, critically important all the time in our practices as practicing gynecologists, we diagnose chlamydia and gonorrhea in individuals that have not known to be carriers. And I'm constantly involved in new tests for these kinds of conditions as well. We have good vaccination against hepatitis B, hepatitis A. There's not good vaccination against hepatitis C, but there's good treatment for it. So screening of asymptomatic carriers of hepatitis C and syphilis and HIV is important. CDC recommends everyone between 15 and 65 get essentially screened every year for HIV. Most of us have not been. So, yeah. We have a lot of work to do in terms of screening.
We have a couple minutes left. Are there any other things that you
Let's
thought
see.
You may mention?
I was going to talk briefly about OVA1. We've talked a lot in the past about the kinds of things that we can do to screen for ovarian cancer. It's the silent killer, the number one killer in terms of female cancers. And unfortunately, ovarian cancer, being the silent killer, often presents in a very advanced stage, whereas endometrial cancer, a more common cancer, often presents in a very early, very treatable stage. And in the past, the only types of screening that we've had for ovarian cancer have been pelvic examinations, pelvic ultrasounds, and the blood test CA125. And now if we find a pelvic mass on ultrasound, the FDA has approved a new five-marker test called OVA1. And it is the CA125 is one of the five markers in OVA1, and you can use the ultrasound finding and the blood results of these five tests, put them together, and come up with a fairly accurate prediction as to whether or not this is a cancer or not a cancer. And some gynecologists feel that this is going to be extremely important breakthrough in helping us figure out which of our patients might benefit the most from being referred to a gynecologic oncologist, in other words, someone who specializes in gynecologic cancers. And on the other hand, we would anticipate most of our patients having a confirmatory test to be assured that the mass that she has is not, in fact, an actual cancer. Whether or not the OVA1 test will actually replace the CA125 as a screening test in the asymptomatic or at-risk patient is not clear yet. That's not its FDA approval, but many physicians are predicting that it may be used that way.
Okay. Well, we're just about at the point, I guess, that we are at the end. Any last sort of thing that you might want to mention?
Well, we wanted to say happy birthday to the birth control pill. And I think you told me that next week you might be covering this subject. It is 50 years old. People are arguing about when it was born and who birthed it, as is always true, I guess, in medicine. But we've gone beyond the birth control pill into lots of permutations on a theme. We have at least 40 different types of birth control pills. We're always involved in research trials. Currently, we're emphasizing not only the fact that it's good contraception, but that it has many medical benefits. And in older women, we know that it can actually help preserve your bone because of the estrogen in it. And in young girls who might be worried that certain types of contraception may not be helpful for your bones, it's important to study the effects of birth control on your bones. And that is one of the research trials we are also currently enrolling, looking at young girls under the age of 18 who would like to use contraception, the health effects of birth control pills on their bones. Okay. They want to write me an email or call.
All right, Dr. Suzanne Troopman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.